everyone, and welcome to episode 82 of the Medieval Podcast. I'm Danielle Sobalski, also known as the 5-Minute Medievalist. It's a well-known fact that the medieval church disapproved of a lot of things. Like, a lot. And perhaps most of them concern people's sex lives. But it's also a well-known fact that the church disapproving of something didn't actually stop people from doing it, especially when it came to people's sex lives. This week, I invited Dr. Bridget Wells Furby to talk to us about her work on medieval marriage, but more specifically, her work on adultery and annulment. B has written 6 books and countless articles, most of them focused on property records and what they can tell us about the medieval world. Her most recent book is Aristocratic Marriage, Adultery, and Divorce in the 14th Century, The Life of Lucy de Thuyng, 1279-1347. Here's our conversation about the remarkable marital life of an English heiress, adultery outside of the pages of medieval romance, and what property records can tell us about real-life people. Well, thank you for joining me, Bea, to talk about aristocratic marriage, adultery, and divorce. I'm so happy to have you here, so thank you for joining me.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you. So your book that caught my attention is about the life of Lucy de Thuyng, and she is a person who lived in the late 13th, early 14th century, and she had quite the marital career. So why don't you tell us a little bit about Lucy and what went on with her life?
Well, she was orphaned as a child and an heiress, which meant that the king had the right to decide on her marriage or sell the right to decide on her marriage, which he gave to a courtier and passed it on to another courtier who married Lucy to his son. Now, that's all pretty normal. I mean, aristocratic marriages were usually arranged for what we would consider to be children between the ages of 7 and 14. And the young people, as a rule, had no choice in it. You know, that sounds dreadful to us, but it's very much a matter of expectations. If you're brought up to believe that that's what's going to happen to you, then it's a lot easier to accept when it does happen. But having said that, there were some young people that did object to marriages successfully, remarkably. So, you know, it's like so many things in Lucy's story, that there was a norm, but that it was only a norm. It wasn't invariable. There were people that kicked over the traces or whatever. But so Lucy's first marriage, nothing particularly out of the ordinary. He was a chap called Latimer. When she turned 14 and was of age to inherit the land, he came into possession of it, which made him wealthy and important, not perhaps quite on the same terms as his father, but on an equal level. And it was all very nice for everybody. And they had a son, a child. The only one that's known was a child. They may have had other ones which didn't live to grow up. But yes, it was all very normal until December 1303, when Lucy left him. And that wasn't quite so common. Having left him, she left him because she wanted to annul the marriage, which we tend to call loosely a divorce. In those days, there wasn't actually such a thing as divorce as we think of it today, that people just decide that, oh, you know, this marriage was a mistake, time to break it. That just didn't happen. There were 2 forms of divorce. One was when the church gave a couple permission to live apart, because otherwise one of them was going to die, be killed by the other. Or the other one was just to annul the marriage altogether, to prove that it had never been valid in the first place. And that's what Lucy was aiming for. And the difficulties in her way were immense. They were physical difficulties, legal difficulties, and financial difficulties. Because while she was still married to Latimer, he still had all the husband's rights over her and her land. And he was perfectly entitled to force her back to him, to force her to stop the ecclesiastical proceedings to annul the marriage. He kept possession of all her lands. She didn't have any right to any income from it. Really, she had nowhere to go because she was supposed to stay with her husband where he told her to stay. But the reason that Lucy was able to be successful in that was because she had the support of her family. She had an uncle, Marmaduke.
I know, it's brilliant.
I know. In the list of silly names. But despite his name, he was a good man, and because he supported her, he organized a band of people, his own men, to go and get her away from the manor that Latimer had told her she had to stay at. And I think that is the most telling aspect, in fact, of how a woman's marriage was. Latimer had gone away to campaign in Scotland, like they mostly all did at that time. And when he left to go on campaign, he had told her that she was to stay at this manor of Kirkburn in Yorkshire. And having said that, she couldn't just get on a horse and go out for a ride or say, OK, guys, I'm just going to go and visit my uncle Marmaduke in York, be back in a couple of days. She couldn't do that. She had to be physically rescued from that place by an armed gang of her uncle's men who went there and took her away. That was the only way that she could get away. I think it's just when you think of all the things about the woman's marriage in those times, that has to be the most telling, I think, most telling facet of it. Anyway, point was, good old Uncle Marmaduke sent his people and got her away. And she then lived with a kinsman, Robert Constable, and his wife while the suit was proceeding in York. And annulment suits were usually pretty swift. When they got to the ecclesiastical court, the Archbishop's court in York, they would usually be dealt with fairly swiftly. But Lucy's divorce was strung out for an enormously long time because the king decided to come down on Latimer's side and awarded Latimer all sorts of extra powers, more even than he had as a husband, to get her back. I mean, he instructed all his local ministers and officials to give Latimer all the help that they could to get Lucy back. And once she was back in his power, you know, that would have been it, end of the suit and everything. So, I mean, those months for Lucy must have been really hellish. And it must have drawn out the ecclesiastical suit for the divorce was so long extended. I mean, and the reason must have been because of all this extra danger and risk of recapture that Lucy was in. Because she couldn't go out anywhere because everybody was authorised by the king to grab her and give her back to her husband. I mean, it was appalling.
Yeah.
Absolutely appalling. But anyway, she did have, as well as good old Uncle Marmaduke, she had the support of the church, which was good and not always the case, I have to say. But the Dean of York, who was in charge of her case, who's also quite a high up royal official, wrote to the king and said, your instructions are delaying the suit and jeopardising Lucy's well-being, and you've got to stop. I don't suppose the king paid much attention to that, but it seems to have been effective. Anyway, because it was only a few months after that that eventually the decree was made in the Archbishop's court. But that, in fact, was not the end of it, because then Latimer, who of course had plenty of money because he had all Lucy's money as well as the lands that he'd inherited from his father in the meantime, he then appealed to the papal court, and that then dragged on for another 7 years. So all that time, in theory, Lucy was still married to Latimer.
In total, it's almost a decade, right? It's 9 years by the time they get to the end of that.
You know, people think that divorce these days is painful enough, but, you know, that takes some lessons from our sisters in the past. But anyway, yes, so that was that. And then it was during this time that she started this relationship with another man. And this is where the adultery comes in.
Mm-hmm.
Because she was, although he wasn't married, she was still technically married to Latimer. So it was in church eyes that when they had sex, they were committing the sin of adultery. If neither of them had been married, it would have been the sin of fornication. I'm not entirely sure whether one is any better than the other, but anyway, it was adultery. And really, I mean, it all sounds terribly exciting and scandalous. And it's, you know, this Lucy's got this dreadful, dreadful reputation arising from some Victorian clergyman who clearly didn't think this was a good thing at all. But it's all this bad reputation of hers, it hinges on this one relationship that she had. And as adultery and scandal goes, it was really so tame. It was positively sanctimonious. It had, I mean, good old, Uncle Marmaduke was there again, still. And he was obviously a friend of, sorry, have I mentioned the lover's name?
Not
his,
yet.
His name, no. His name was Nicholas Mennell. And Marmaduke was obviously on extremely good terms with Mennell, and also Marmaduke's younger brother. It was only probably a while after they started living together that they were actually first condemned by the church. And it seems quite likely that actually that was instigated by Latimer. There was a lot of tit-for-tat going on at the time between the Thwaites and the Latimers. The Thwaites had reminded the Archbishop that Latimer ought to be excommunicated for not having paid the costs of the ecclesiastical suit. And it seems quite likely that Latimer, as a riposte, had said, look at her! Look at her! She's living in sin with this other man. That's adultery. So the church was obliged to take notice of it. And their little reprimands went on for a while. But it's quite clear because in the church records, on only some occasions was Lucy identified as wife of Latimer. In a lot of them, she's just identified as Lucy, daughter of Robert the Thwing, as single women or divorced women were. So there was clearly a huge amount of ambivalence about her marital status, and the church really, and the little penalties that they imposed were not serious. On the last one, there was a penalty that they were to pay if they again had sex together before they were married. And that was quite a common thing. And it meant that these people were meant, you know, they meant to get married, but, you know, they hadn't quite got around to it. And yeah, okay, we'll promise we'll do it soon. That sort of thing. And of course, the reason they couldn't get married was because Lucy was still technically married to Latimer. So there was this, and they had a son, and they possibly had a daughter as well. And of course, the son was technically illegitimate. Well, not technically, but was illegitimate because his parents were not married at the time. So then they eventually managed to get the divorce, and it was probably because Lucy agreed to give Latimer half her lands. And there was probably quite a lot of hard negotiation going on before that. And maybe it was also long drawn out because of these negotiations. Who would know? But anyway, there was a deal with regard to the settlement of the land, and then quite soon after that, the divorce was finalised. Wow, bang. We know that the divorce had gone through in July 1312 because of the arrangements that were being made about the land at the time. The next thing we know about Lucy is January 1313, when she's married to somebody else altogether.
Surprise!
Yeah, woo! That wasn't expecting that. But the only reason we know that she was married to this third man, whose name was Everingham, was because he complained that Menel, the lover, had abducted her away from him, taken her away from him. So there's something clearly very strange going on here. Mm-hmm. I mean, everybody, the Lucy's family, the church, everybody expected that Lucy and Menel would marry as soon as she was free. But as soon as she was free, she's married to this third man. And what, after a very lengthy discussion in the book about all the possible reasons why this might be, it does seem likely that she was forced into this marriage, abducted and probably raped to consummate it and make it legal. Mm-hmm. And this was not uncommon. Women, usually widows, not divorced women, but women who were left on their own and had land were vulnerable, very vulnerable. And it happened a lot, and it probably happened a great deal more often than the records show, because if that had happened to a woman, very probably many of them would just submit to it, not make a fuss about it, because of the potential humiliation and embarrassment of having to admit what had happened. So probably it happened a great deal more than we know about. We do know of some that objected and fought back. And it just seems extremely likely that this is what had happened to Lucy, partly because, as I say, the first thing we know about it is that Menel had taken her back. Mm-hmm. So quite clearly that relationship hadn't faded in any way. And there's also much greater evidence of that because it was while she was married to Everingham, just a year later, in 1314, that Menel actually did something quite extraordinary, which was to carry out a legal settlement of all his land so that it would pass on his death to their illegitimate son, and created him as his heir, which again, not entirely unknown, but it was, this settlement was really quite exceptional in that Menel was still under 40 at the time. He'd never married anybody else, and he never did marry anybody else, which was unusual. And it was his entire estate, not just a part of it. He bought extra lands to add to the inheritance, and he arranged a very, very, very respectable marriage for this lad, which absolutely cemented his position as the heir, as if he had been legitimate. So all this went on. So Menel did this while she was married to Everingham. And it seems very clear to me that the relationship between Lucy and Nicholas was close and continued to be close, and that they did intend to marry, and that the only reason they could not was because of this, because she was abducted from Everingham. But even then, Menel did not give up on her. He rescued her, and probably was responsible for sorting out yet another land deal with her estate for the benefit of the second husband. Everingham was quite young. It's quite possible. I mean, Lucy quite obviously couldn't get a second divorce. That would have been really exceptional. Mm-hmm. So they'd obviously decided they would have to live with it. There was probably some sort of agreement of a modus vivendi. I mean, Everingham probably only wanted the land. He'd got the land. He was prepared to settle for whatever Lucy did. I mean, she may well have gone back to live with Mennell. I mean, we don't know because there's not enough. I mean, they did the usual things jointly as a married couple had to do in respect to her land. But it's possible that there was a modus vivendi, and possibly Lucy was living with Mennell, but it was certainly at that time that he made the settlement, which made their son his heir. And it may be that they did that because he didn't expect to have a chance to marry Lucy. Mm-hmm. And time was getting on, and you know that it was probably necessary to be done. And probably what they didn't expect was that Everingham would die just a couple of years later, still very young. So, of course, this gave Lucy and Mennell another chance to get married. But again, they didn't. And the reason for that may have been because if they had, and then had another son, he would have been a legitimate heir, which would have jeopardized the position of their elder son. It's a possibility. I don't know. It's worth thinking about. I mean, it's true, and that may have been the reason why they did. But they didn't marry, so Lucy was actually a widow, and she obviously was a bit more careful this time because she managed to stay a widow. And then, all very sad, Mennell died quite young and suspiciously close to a battle that he was probably at, so he may have died of wounds taken at the battle in 1322. Uncle Marmaduke died in 1323, all very sad. And then Latimer finally died. Her first husband finally died in 1327. And then within months of Latimer dying, she was married again to her third husband, who was of a Yorkshire landholder of slightly strange background because his father was probably French. And his name was Bartholomew, but he occasionally appears in the records as Bertin, which I suspect was probably his French name, and Bartholomew was his sort of English, anglicised version. But it seems possible that Lucy had known him for quite a while. He had been connected with Latimer, although it's slightly difficult to interpret the evidence. But as I say, it seems quite likely that they'd known each other for some time. They were much of an age, and she stayed married to him for the last 20 years of her life, apparently on reasonably amicable grounds. It's very difficult to tell, of course, when there's so little to judge on, but it seems to have been he allowed her to make a will. In that will, she trusted him to make all the various arrangements for her soul after her death. She settled what was left of her land on him. It was only, and that settlement was done only sort of something like 10 years after they were married, so it certainly wasn't forced on her. It's to all appearances it was a final marriage to somebody that was to not exactly an old friend, but a congenial companion. So she eventually came to a safe harbour after lots of tribulations.
Oh, for sure. I mean, you know, you're saying it was only months after Latimer died, after Uncle Marmaduke died, that she got married again. And I would think that would be something that you could expect from Lucy. She's had such a rough go of it, you know, people abducting her and things like that. That to settle her own marriage is a very wise thing to do, especially with a friend. Now, I want to ask about Uncle Marmaduke, because this is something I've seen when you do see women who are getting out of marriages, or it's a bad situation, or they're looking for annulments, they will often go back to their families, and often, at least the records that I've seen, they are supported. Do you think is that a trend that you've seen as well, that families are supportive to women who sometimes leave their marriages?
Definitely. The only thing that slightly worries me about the evidence is that we tend to know about the support of families when annulments were successful, mm-hmm. or abductions or whatever. It's possible that, of course, there were other women who desperately wanted to get away and couldn't because they didn't have the support of their family. Mm-hmm. So whether what we're seeing is just the tiny minority that did, or whether it's the fault of the records and that there was much more of it going on, be very difficult to say.
Yeah, it comes back to me for that idea people have of whether they love their children or not. And to me, this seems like evidence that people did love their children enough to bring them home when they were in a bad situation.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. It's another thing that's very interesting is when there were separations, private separations, not church-sanctioned ones. All the arrangements that were made for separate financial income for the mother, the separated wife, also included her children, which I think is interesting. So the children went with the mother. They didn't, I mean, that was a lot more liberal than, I mean, in Victorian England, for God's sake, if a woman was separated or divorced her husband, the children stayed with their father, mm-hmm. and that was it, regardless. So I think that's, in one way, that's the medieval times were much more tolerant than later ones.
Yeah, I wonder if that has to do with, you know, Virgin Mary thing, but that's probably a whole other podcast. Okay, I do want to get into adultery, though, because the Middle Ages is a place, time, where you have adulteries all over romances and stories, and people love it in their stories, but technically it's not allowed, and people could be punished for it pretty severely. And yet, there is acceptance in cases. You have quite a few cases in here where people are openly living in adultery, and everyone just kind of goes, meh, not a big deal. So tell us a little bit about that. Like, what would happen to you if you're caught, you know, technically caught as an adulterer, adulteress, but then how did it actually play out in real life? Can you tell us a bit about that?
Well, it's one of those interesting things, and like so many things, that real life didn't seem to go along with what was the technical rules. Yes, the church had this big down on sex.
That's an understatement. Like,
yeah, it really didn't approve of sex at all. And, you know, resolved its dilemma by saying, well, okay, you can do it only if you have a license. Yeah. We'll give you the license, and that's mm-hmm. it. And any sex that's not covered by the license is wrong and bad, and we'll punish you for it. And there are, you know, there is evidence in church courts of all sorts of punishments, people being made to process through the streets and physically humiliating penances of that type. Others, perhaps luckier, were just got off with a fine, you know, £10 or £100 to the Holy Land or to the fabric of church minster, the York Minster or something. It's very difficult to actually work out whether there was any logic behind the differing punishment for adultery. I certainly couldn't see any. I think repeat adulterers, you can just about see that, you know, if they kept on doing it, it got, with different women, it got worse, or different men rather. But there really isn't, but I think it may be something to do with the fact that our church records are just so scrappy, patchy, they're perhaps not enough to really judge on. But so yes, so there is this thing that the church did come down heavily on people who were found in adultery. But then there is quite a lot of evidence that all this was going on, a lot of it was going on, with no condemnation. I mean, obviously, the cases that I spoke about in the book, they're mostly, we know about them because they're mentioned in church records, however lightly or heavily they were punished for it. But rather annoyingly, since I finished that book, I've come across two or three other cases as well. And these were women of landholding rank who had an adulterous relationship which resulted in children, and there is no evidence that they were condemned by the church. But of course, that again, that may be because the church records are so scanty and so forth, they may have been punished. But so there's no doubt a certain amount of it went on. And again, I mean, who can say how contemporaries really viewed it? It's very difficult. I mean, you get the odd scrap of anecdotal evidence, like, for instance, that the Rooses, one of the big families in Yorkshire, were very happy for their daughter to marry Nicholas Mennell, the bastard, as though they had entirely accepted the relationship between his father and Lucy, although it might have been more to do with the fact that actually he was just going to be a very wealthy young man when his father died. You know, who knows? And then there are things like, one of the most famous cases of adultery was the Margaret de Gateston, John de Camoys, William Paynell thing.
Yeah.
I know. Yeah, quite. Why, if you fall in love with somebody else, that's okay. Well, all right, then I'll give you to him. And we'll make an arrangement about your lands. You can have some of those. And it's all so civilized and amazing. And it's absolutely fine. What is particularly interesting about that was that her son by Camoys the legitimate son. Well, in fact, she didn't have any children by Paynell, but he was obviously completely cool about it as well, because he asked his mother, and by that time his stepfather, to be his feffies in making a settlement of land. You know, so that's all fine. it's really mind-boggling. You know, you can't. On the one hand, there's the church throwing fire and brimstone about, you know, you'll all go to hell. And on the other, there's this perfectly relaxed sort of total attitude that says, but I suspect what it was is that as with most things, is that people used it if it was to their advantage. If they wanted to make a fuss, they would report people to the church authorities, keep things stirred up. If you didn't, who cared, really? I mean, the wife might have cared, obviously, if she was turfed out of the marital home, occasionally happened.
Yeah, I think of in terms of human relationships, like we think about cities a lot of times where there's a lot of people and it's fairly relatively anonymous, but in places that are smaller, everybody knows everybody else. And maybe if you're just a nice person and you've had a bad situation, a bad marriage, and here you are, you're allowed to live with your lover. Like, who cares? We don't need to stir anything up. Besides the fact that maybe if you stir things up, it might come back on you as well. But I think of it in terms of kind of a small town attitude where you know everybody. Like in courts where you have to have a whole bunch of people testify to your character. It's good to be a good person because then you get away with, you know, lots of stuff. So to me, it seems like if you just are a nice person, you may not have all that much trouble, even though you have the church saying this is absolutely terrible. And that maybe, you know, people are not looking back to the Middle Ages and seeing that human element, which is why I like the case studies that you have in your book.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, I believe very firmly that actually human nature doesn't change.
Yeah.
People then, you know, they lived in with slightly different parameters and slightly different expectations. And of course, they did live with this huge black cloud of the church over there. But on the whole, you know, their human emotions are going to be pretty much the same as we are now. And, you know, people are going to get cross about things and lose their temper. Maybe they get drunk and say, I'm not putting up with this any longer. And I'm going to go and toddle off and probably wake up in the morning saying, oh, God, I wish I hadn't done that.
Yeah. Yep.
But, you know, or you know, they lose their temper because they're humiliated over something, or all those things that they all must have played a part. And I'm sure it's, you know, as historians, we get our source material, we look at it, we analyze it, we subject it to statistics, we do all this sort of thing. And at the end of it, we think, okay, but now we've got to factor in the complete wild card of human emotions and all the stuff that we don't actually know. So it's very difficult to tell, but I do think that a lot of the stuff that puzzles people is just down to somebody getting cross or somebody getting out, you know, whatever.
Yeah. But I like those moments. And you're very careful in the book. You're not making huge assumptions based on nothing. But I think that you're right in getting at, it seems like Menno and Lucy had a real relationship.
Yes.
In that, you know, he didn't marry anyone else and he rescued her and, you know, all of these things. And it's nice to see those human stories come through when you have such little evidence. It seems like this is a relationship. And I really think someone needs to write a book about Lucy, like a fictional book, or do a movie.
I know, don't. Everybody always says, oh my God, this has got to be a BBC miniseries. This has got to be. And everybody's got their idea of who's going to be starring in what role and all this sort of thing.
You have a lot of opportunities for a great leading man in this story. And a heroine for everyone.
Yeah, I know. Funnily enough, the one that everybody says is that Uncle Marmaduke has to be Sean Bean.
Yes.
He has the Yorkshire accent and everything. So,
for sure.
There's a certain amount of debate about the other characters. Anyway, yes, I mean, it is Hollywood. I mean, it couldn't be better, could it? It's amazing. It's the most amazing story. But the difficulty that I had was that I got so involved with it, all the other women as well, because mm-hmm. when I first came across Lucy, which was, oh God, years ago, the story that I was reading was this Victorian story that had somehow managed to persist, that, oh, she was a notorious woman, she had all these hundreds of affairs, and she left her, and she was, oh yes, that was the thing, Latimer divorced her. Well, hadn't they looked at the sources? No. Lucy left him. And the hundreds of affairs, somebody picked up from somewhere that Uncle Marmaduke had been one of her lovers. And it was just like this sort of 14th century Yorkshire Lucrezia Borgia going around creating absolute havoc in Yorkshire through some witch-like spell that she cast on all these men. I mean, and I just thought, well, she sounds like fun. Mm-hmm. And started to look. And of course, the more work I did, in one way, it was slightly disappointing because I thought, well, actually, there isn't anything very exciting here. Not terribly scandalous and exciting. And also the fact that she was not alone in any of the things that happened to her. She wasn't alone in leaving her husband and divorcing him. She certainly wasn't alone in being abducted and raped. And she wasn't alone in having a relationship with somebody that she wasn't married to. And that all made her seem slightly less exciting. But actually, it was so gripping finding out about all these other women. But then, of course, I kept kind of losing the plot. I had to say, come on, I've got to focus. Get back to Lucy. She's the person. Mm-hmm. So it was a strange book to write, really. But yes, her story is an interesting one. And it's, interesting woman.
Yeah, she's an interesting woman. And all the women in here are very, very interesting. And the men have good roles too, but yeah, we so seldom get to see the women's side of marriage, and it's a really great book for that. So I really want to thank you for coming on and telling us about Lucy and the other women of her time and how you didn't necessarily fit into that mold that we tend to shove them into. So thank you so much, Bea, for coming to talk to me.
Thank you for having me.
To find out more about Bea's work, check out her website at wellsfurby.com. That's wells-furby.com. Her book is Aristocratic Marriage, Adultery, and Divorce in the 14th Century, The Life of Lucy de Thwaing, 1279 to 1347. Before we go, here's Peter from medievalist.net to tell us what's on the website. What's new this week, Peter?
Hey. Well, this week we have a pretty nice mix of pieces. You can learn about acorns in the Middle Ages, from peasant food to upper class food. So, how the Venetian Republic dealt with the Black Death. Plus, we have also our columns on medieval movies and fiction set in the Middle Ages. And also another piece by Elizabeth Smith Ross, our historian on medieval China. And this month, she's telling us about a few examples where the child emperor has to play the Game of Thrones with their mother, the Empress Dowager.
Ooh, that's all the time in medieval China, isn't it? It's like constantly Game of Thrones.
Yes, when they have multiple empires, that's always a lot of fun. So, because they're always playing off each other, and yeah, nothing like a lot of politics.
There's always something new and exciting to learn about medieval China. And Peter, like, the stuff that's coming out in medievalist.net is getting to be more and more expansive and interesting, and it's really great. I'm feeling great about the content that you're putting out on medievalist.net. You feeling good about it?
Yeah, thanks so much. Yeah, I really love that. You know, we've got this really good team of writers, including yourself, that have been, you know, kind of producing these great articles. And, you know, just you can learn everything from kind of the like nitty gritty of politics to like, you know, daily life. And that's really what, you know, we want on medievalist.net, to give you a really broad view of the medieval world.
Yeah, and it's getting broader and broader all the time on the website. So you're doing great work, Peter. Congratulations.
Thanks so much.
And we will talk to you next week.
Bye-bye.
Thank you to each and every one of our patrons on patreon.com for all your support. If you're not yet a patron, check out our awesome goodies, from subscriptions to Medieval Warfare Magazine and the Medieval Magazine, to our book club books and our exclusive maps by Tina Ross. There's something great for everyone at every tier, even if it's just my heartfelt thanks. Find out more at patreon.com/medievalists. This weekend, I'll be giving some tips and tricks on how to survive and thrive during the zombie apocalypse with my friend and emergency and wilderness survival doctor, Joe Alcock. We'll be presenting our best advice as a team, and I'll also be talking to Dr. Emily Zarka, the host of PBS's Monstrum, about what I'd throw in my go bag in case of zombie emergencies. If you're interested in that and all sorts of amazing discoveries from real scientists shared in a really fun way, check out the Zombie Apocalypse Medicine Meeting at zombiemed.org for more information. For everything from acorns to Avalon, follow medievalist.net on Facebook or Twitter at medievalist. You can follow me, Danielle Cebulski, on social media at 5MIN Medievalist or 5 Minute Medievalist. And you might want to think about following me because I should have a pretty cool announcement for you very soon. You can find my books at your favorite online bookstores. Our music is Beyond the Warriors by Guy Frog. Thanks for listening and have yourself an awesome day.